Chapter 3. This is it. Bunny Horval was an hour late when he swung his Holden station wagon into the curbing by the Brewarrina Hotel. His impatience was obvious, and I had barely enough time to wrestle the suitcase under the back seat and climb in before we tore away in a cloud of dust. We sped north between a church and a convent and over a narrow gully identified with the word Cato, then crossed the brown waters of the Barwon River on a bridge which required perfect steering on uneven, elevated planks. The shock absorbers worked overtime, and when the Holden left the bridge, it catapulted into space and nosedived into the dark dirt beyond. This would be some ride. The sun struck out behind us in a lazy climb, turning pebbles into stars and setting large tracts of clay into galaxial fire. We raced on until we leapfrogged a third wooden span, and Bunny spoke at last. Hospital Creek. People were massacred there. Back through the billowing cloud, I observed a narrow channel in the hard-baked ground. The creek bank was lined with gibbers, small rocks, angular and sharp, which seemed the colour of dried blood against the tawny earth when the sun reflected from them. Bunny switched on the radio and left me wrestling with the image of a gruesome moment, perhaps a century past. "Who was massacred?" I asked. "Aboriginals. They used to hunt them for sport. Sunday afternoon, someone might say, 'Let's get us some abos.' They killed a lot right there in that creek bed, so help me God."
"Who's they?"
"Bushmen. There was a movement at the turn of the century to wipe out the blacks. The largest massacre was back there. See how open the country is? There was no escape for the families camped in the creek. The bushmen rode in from two directions and shot them with muzzle loaders. Men, women and children.
Just for the hell of it?
Blah, land-grabbing, sport, superior race. Does it need a name? Ah, they said the blacks had been spearing cattle at a place near the river known as the Butcher's Tree, but the truth never came out. How many people were killed? We've never recorded." Bunny studied the speedometer and urged the car to go faster. Both hands gripped the vibrating steering wheel, for the road was deeply worn and best attempted by straddling the ruts. Losing a wheel could mean disaster, but speed seemed to be important to Bunny.
"That telegraph line over there was built from Tamworth to Bourke in 1872 to get the river reports. This whole area lived and died by the riverboat trade."
I made no comment on the never-ending slash of poles, though it was hard to conceive of the area being dependent on boat trade when the only hint of moisture was the perspiration on Bunny's upper lip. His flabby biceps, paunch and pudgy hands said a lot about Bunny and physical labour. He had to be a clerk.
"Barges used to get hung up on river snags. Others would be marooned for months in shallow waters. It may not look like it, but there's a lot of history out here. I like history."
His eyes became narrow slits as he thumped over a series of corrugations without slowing down. The unfenced road was becoming less obvious on the plain. On the radio, Patsy Cline began singing, "I Fall to Pieces," and he drummed on the steering wheel with his wedding ring. I tried to relax. History at my age was a disjointed set of pictures, a name here, a date there, an act of courage or cowardice, victory or defeat, a complicated detailing of cause and effect. I had a mind for storing such knowledge, but each fact was like a small piece of a giant jigsaw puzzle, and until I had more pieces in place, the picture would never make much sense. The massacre was still on my mind, a disturbing discovery. I had no previous knowledge of the lawless pursuit of the black man and had naively thought they were on equal footing in the outback. Why hadn't they taught us this in school? Aboriginals belonged here. They had chosen not to relocate. Whether this decision was respected or held in contempt was too soon for me to tell. "You walk by and I fall to pieces," Patsy Cline finished. Putting history aside, I said, "I haven't seen a single woman since I left Dubbo." "Yeah, well, very few single women out here." "You know, lots of good-looking sheep, though, right? I've been warned about that. Are there any girls out here?" "Oh, Paddy O'Reilly, a mate of mine up on the Queensland border. He's got three daughters, Jill, Janelle and young Lucy." "Oh, you might have your hands full with young Lucy. She's already laid some claim to you. You are eligible, aren't you? If you're going to survive out here, mate, you have to learn to do with less, much less."
"Less? It's better than nothing."
"It depends on how particular you are.
I wondered how particular Bunny was. His shirt and shorts, clean and pressed, were a fastidious match. His aftershave lotion had been freshly and liberally applied. He had shown a great deal of charm in the hotel. "Do you have any children?" I asked. "Of course. Why do you think you're here? I've got four. There's Bernard, he's named after me, Leo, Stephen and Mary. Bernard and Leo will be going to school when we get it finished." When you get what finished? The school? "Yes, it's not finished yet. Didn't they tell you?" "No, who's they? Jesus, don't tell me there's no school." Bunny let me wrestle with the incomprehensible. No school? All that summer I'd worked in a small factory die-casting belt buckles. The molten lead had scalded my hands and chest when I'd been careless because of the mechanical drudgery and more preoccupied with the possibilities of my first school assignment. School buildings, to me, meant those in which I'd been an assistant or an observer, like the three-roomed arrangement at Narandra and the two old brick rooms at Kellyville. Now I had to erase the presumption of a structure and imagine holding class on a patch of sod. What an injustice! If there was no school at Wilmer Ingle, the telegram had been mightily deceitful. What had it said? Appointed teacher at Wilmer Ingle. The word school omitted. Bunny, rubbing the Catholic cross around his neck, said, "There's never been a school there. A couple of us got together about 18 months ago with the idea of trying to get one at either Collarina or Wilmer Ingle. Our kids had been getting by on correspondence, and a couple of families had hired governesses from Sydney, but I found out the government was legally bound to establish a public school whenever 9 or more kids could attend." "And how many kids are there?" "Five." "Five? Well, there's five whites, but there's an Aboriginal camp nearby. There must be over 100 people there. More than enough kids. Look, a lot of time and effort went into getting you. An official from the Department of Education even came out just before Christmas. A month ago. Doesn't leave much time to build a school." "You're right. We promised to build a temporary schoolhouse and find accommodation for the teacher, and they agreed to send someone who was qualified. Oh, and here I am, bloody marvellous." I had to laugh. "Well, that remains to be seen. Not everybody thought it was a good idea. The Western Lands Commission have no use for a teacher. They oversee the use of land out here. Even the Department of Education is adversarial to a degree. If it wasn't for Jack Renshaw, we wouldn't even have been given a 12-month trial. He's the local Member of Parliament for the Castlereagh. He believed in us. He'll be Premier of New South Wales one day, you watch. Still, you're not what I expected." "Yeah, it's not what I expected." "Yeah, well, I was hoping for someone with more experience. You can't play with this part of the country. It needs men." "I thought it made men." I had read that somewhere. "Anyway," I said, "you're stuck with me for now. School starts on Tuesday." "Well, it should be ready by then. You might have to give us a hand to finish it." "Oh, sure, building your own school, a popular course in college." Bunny ignored the sarcasm. "It is a bit unusual, but that's the way of things out here. Property owners have made a start. Lenny Davis, Alan Thompson, Edgar Fessy and I formed a parent committee. Edgar's the president. Each of us put in 50 quid to buy material to build a temporary school. Monica Bartley and Tout Heitzman also put in £50. Sand and gravel was donated by Barbara and Douglas Webb at Bukulla. Boobah Lucas and John Mann have been doing a lot of the actual work." A swirl of dust ahead grew as Bunny closed the gap and overtook a rusting green truck, forcing it wide on the road allowance but tooting the horn and waving at the Aboriginal driver. One of the boys riding in the back glared as we passed. Was he the boy I'd seen when I'd limped into town? I twisted around and waved, and he half-waved back. "Valley Orchard," Bunny said. "Probably spent the night in jail. Drunk. Locked up for his own good. I call it preventative police work. Keeps people like Valley from getting into further trouble and hurting themselves. Not that they like being locked up. Suicides have been reported. The school might draw some of them away from the temptation of town." "No pub at Wilmer Ingle, right?" "Of course not." Bunny made the question seem silly. "What kind of place is no pub?" I opened my arms imploringly. "You'll see." He glanced in the rear vision mirror. "There's plenty of work for them out here if they want it. They're good riders and good stockmen, but a lot won't work if they've got a few quid left in their pocket. Not much point to it, really. Anyone who tries to make a go of it is usually forced to share his wages with the mob anyway." Well, I didn't challenge Bunny's generalizations, not that he minced words, but I determined to form my own impressions of the ancient race. The implication was that, as a stockman, the Aboriginal was every bit as good as a white man. Equality by any other measure was not on.
Were they savages?
Who's looking out for their interests? I asked. Oh, the Aboriginal Protection Board. Charity's the name of the game. It's broken, the black fella. How can you have any pride left when no one expects anything of you? Valley's a good man. Cares for his family, wants his kids educated. It's a strange name, Valley. That's short for Valentine. His friends call him Bally. They can't say their V's. There's Valley, Dudley, Jimmy, Sonny, Arthur and Billy, and about five sisters. Jack's always been a bit of a rebel. I tried to make the connection. Who was Jack? Bunny had a perverse way of leaving off a topic in an incompleted state. It was hard to tell whether he'd added a tidbit or left something unsaid. We lapsed into silence, the choking dust reason enough to keep our mouths shut. Rough, gravelled causeways cut across the road, water courses long unused, but proving that wet times were possible and that surface water had to run off and find its way to the ocean. Periodically we rattled up and over iron cattle grids that, because of the wire fences that met them on either side, indicated a change of paddock or a change of property. Bunny just raced over those bone-crushing grids, most of which stood high enough to send us airborne for two or three heartbeats. The grey and pink salt pans stretched away, carrying the fences and eroded gullies with them. But since vanishing points on the flat expanse were hard to define, there was no sense of perspective. Nothing had a telltale beginning or end, nor were there directional signs, as though it was assumed people knew their way around. History might have been all the space held, and Bunny sensed my confusion. See that stone chimney over there? It used to be a pub. My wife's grandmother came all the way out here from Ireland. Talk about hardship? We didn't know the half of it. Imagine crossing the world in an old freighter and ending up out here. Could life have been any worse in Ireland? The ox carts would stop as they travelled west. There's few signs left of the old teamster's route. You have to know where to look. I could barely make out a pile of rubble fixed among the spiralling tumbleweed. How long had it taken the oxen teams plodding with their bales of wool to reach anywhere? They could still be out there in the misty heat. A cloud of dust on the long white road, and the teams go drifting on, inch by inch with the weary load. Henry Lawson, said Bunny, came out here in the late 1800s, but he didn't stay. You know the rest of the poem? No, bits of verse raveled together like history. The bullock teams covered 6 miles a day. It was hot work. No kidding. Well, it hasn't rained in 2 years, said Bunny solemnly. Fair dinkum, no rain for 2 years? Well, rain that would do anybody any good. He glanced at the cloudless sky. The last time it rained, I was at an Aboriginal funeral. The priest had the sermon written out in ink on a piece of paper, and every so often he'd pause to give the mourners a chance to chant. Well, damned if it doesn't start to rain. Bloody great drops. I look over, and these big splotches are spreading over the sermon. The sermon's being washed away before the poor bastard's eyes. Bunny paused. I took my cue, asking, so what happened? Without faltering, the priest says, no finer horseman ever held the reins. Patterson, I said, the man from Snowy River. Exactly. He pretends to be reading, but he starts reciting Patterson. No one else notices. Amen, the abbos chant. He let the pony have his head, says the priest, and everyone chants, amen, again. Bunny began chuckling, and I laughed in spite of myself. Well, he must have rattled off 4 or 5 verses, and no one but me was any the wiser. In fact, when it was over, the congregation felt it was the best bloody tribute ever paid an Aboriginal stockman. So help me God. I complimented Bunny on the story while wondering what life without a shower of rain might be like. Bunny read my thoughts. It's tough. We've burned and buried a lot of sheep. That's a lot of money. He pointed to a stand of wattle. That's why we have to control those buggers. What buggers? Kangaroos. Can't see them? They're all around us. Oh, you'll be able to pick them out after you've been here a while. See the V above that black stump? The horn honked, and a narrow head popped up. Suddenly, kangaroos rose to their haunches all about us and began loping lazily in no fixed direction. I sat upright. There must have been 30 of them, bouncing over the flats with a comfortable locomotion, quite at home in the heat. Bunny went on, they compete with the sheep for grass, real pests. But they know how to survive. They'd be a study if they were in the Galapagos. You know where they are?" He looked at me quizzically, and again I had the impression he was taking my measure. It was becoming obvious that our lives were to be linked as closely as convicts on a chain, and we'd have to find a harmony in order to move as one. I don't think Bunny found my youthful past worth discussing. He preferred talking about himself. He wasn't overbearing, but I found it hard to suffer his praise for the virtues of the land when it was a great disappointment to me. Bunny was steeped in the folklore and shared it confidently and willingly. I was a good listener, but it would serve no purpose if I appeared to be baffled into silence. Unfortunately, I didn't know whether Darwin's islands were off the coast of Africa or South America, and I said so. "You're a teacher, aren't you? I thought you liked history." "I do," I said defensively. "That's geography." We took a hard left turn onto a narrow, less defined track, and I realized there'd been no road sign since we left Brewarrina, as though it was presumed everyone knew where they were going. I wondered whether I'd ever be driving alone out here, and I had no driver's license yet, and whether I'd be around long enough to think there was some place worth driving to. The sand track we now followed could be lost on a clay pan. Other similar paths took off periodically, headed for a station homestead or a watering hole or shearer's quarters. We were certainly getting deeper into the wilderness because kangaroo carcasses were a more common sight. Fatalities caused by vehicles. These twisted, bloodied, eyeless messes of fur by the roadside, Bunny found unworthy of comment. "That's the Langboyd turnoff, if you're interested. There used to be a big pub there, too." A strong smell, putrid, like ammonia, or decaying fish, or burnt vinegar, new to me, hard to define, swept into the car. So foul a stench, I held my breath and swiftly closed the window. "Phew, what is that? It's worse than the urine smell I had to sleep with last night." Bunny sniffed the air agreeably. "Gidgee, those trees over there, wattle trees. Slang term is stinkin' wattle. Pong's like rotten meat when it's really damp. Not so bad at the moment. Now you get used to it. Much of the Gidgee was killed 100 years ago to allow grass to grow. Chinese gangs did the work. You can still see where the trunks were ring-barked. We call this run country." I slumped in the seat, defeated and petulant. The deathly quiet, the oppressive heat, the choking dust and dopey flies, the very air I had to breathe, all an affront to my comfort. As we sped along the disappearing track, hope became an abandoned thing. I would fail out here. I would be the world's worst teacher, incapable of teaching anyone anything. It was easy to hate the place for that reason alone. I didn't belong out here. How long would I be able to stand it? Bunny, oblivious to my dismal thoughts, continued to elaborate on a wide range of topics, from the success of the Australian swimmers at the Rome Olympics to the American election of a Catholic president. He expressed some surprise that I hadn't read Exodus or seen Spartacus, and reminded me of my father creeping again to the forefront of my thoughts. A brilliant man in his own right, dominating and quick to deplore the shortcomings of others. We finally bounced over a whitewashed wooden bridge where a small sign read, "Colgo River." Coarse grass grew sporadically in the bottom of the huge empty trough beneath the bridge. "This is the main tributary of the Darling River," Bunny said. The Darling was the longest river in Australia. It fed the Murray River. This ugly tributary chasm, Colgo River Crater, was roughly 6 car lengths in width, and chiseled its way through the earthen tablecloth top to a depth that would hide a house. While it ambled off to barely obvious higher and lower elevations, it hadn't ferried water for a very long time. 4 dry and peeling wood corrals appeared to the left as the car veered right. Further to the right, toward the empty river trough, a large homestead was almost hidden behind well-established wisteria and other cultured vines and shrubs. 3 metal-roofed outsheds nearby stood stark in the shimmering heat. Bunny headed for the only other building in sight, a squat, fibro-sheeted house, white with an ochre-coloured iron roof and a partial veranda across the back. It was a cheerless dwelling, unadorned with landscaped effort, baking unprotected on the flats. "I thought we were stopping for a drink," when Bunny said offhandedly, "Well, this is it." "This is what?" "Wilmer Engel, what else?" I thought, my God.